2-2 pitch. Swing and a long drive. Deep left. Way back. Go!
We're gonna start this thing. You can do a formal intro in a second. Little did Jeff know that a shark has been on this earth longer than dinosaurs.
That seems like one of those facts that you see in a meme, and it's not true.
Jeff thinks that, well, it came from my wife, and my wife is typically pretty well fact-checked. See, Jeff thought sharks, when you type in sharks, first thing on Google, it says fish. Jeff thought sharks were mammals.
Yeah, I guess that was wrong.
No, sharks are fish, not mammals. That's what Google's
whales,
telling.
Whales are mammals. Dolphins.
Sharks differ from mammals in many ways, including warm blood. Mammals are warm-blooded, but sharks are ectothermic, meaning their body temperature matches the water around them. Anyway, what were we saying? We were saying Jesus was a big fan of the San Jose Sharks, fish.
I'm going to have to cut all this.
The Miami Marlins and the Miami Dolphins. Those were his three big professional sports teams. There were no professional sports teams that were fish in the NBA. I'm sure there's college fish out there somewhere, but besides the point, at the end of the day, it just comes back down to traditions, Jeff. And we're going to put, if anybody cares to know what the rest of that conversation was, you can reach out to us individually or group DM on Twitter.
Apparently sharks are older than, trees.
Sharks are some badasses.
Sharks. I don't buy this. This seems.
I saw a video on Twitter last week. Twitter's been unhinged since it became X. I saw a video of a shark getting absolutely gulped by what was the name of the fish? I mean, I've seen sharks getting smacked around by whales, but it was a fish, a grouper. I think it was like an oversized grouper. It just came up and ate the shark whole. I was like, dang, grouper.
So, like, that puts me above the sharks in the food chain because I eat groupers.
Shout out to Keon Coleman. Do you want me to sign my full name or my autograph? You want me to sign my full name here or my autograph? You know, like, I sign my autograph different than my full name. Keon, it's your contract. Sign your full name. Shout out to Keon Coleman. He always gives me a good laugh. I think Buffalo Bills fans are going to love that guy for a long time. All right, Jeff, give us an intro.
All right. Welcome back to the 90th percentile. It's been a little bit. This is your host, Jeff Ponce. Alongside me, as always, is my co-host, Matt Pajak of Logan Chica Sports. It's like totally thrown off.
Matt Boca Chica.
I started scatting your name. I don't.
Yeah, I was like, what the heck?
Skip, skibbity, bop, bop, boop. So there you go. But Matt, we are talking some potential pitch metrics this week, but really just some of the other things to understand besides just singular numbers when you're looking at pitch movement, right? This is sort of started because I've seen a lot of people just sort of blindly talking IVB, not necessarily talking about what the vertical break is with release traits and some of these other things. Playing on the fastball and how even fastballs that sit 95 with, 17 inches of induced vertical break, 18 inches of induced vertical break can be hit and consistently. I think this all sort of spawned from a conversation we had about Chase Burns versus Hagen Smith, some of the other pitchers in the draft, and why we both, I think, have some concerns with Chase Burns. Not like overblown, like this guy is going nowhere. It's none of those, one of those conversations. But just in terms of like, gave up, was it 14 homers this year? And it's hard contact. I think if you've watched some Chase Burns starts, has been a consistent bugaboo for him. So,
Yeah, look, Jeff, like you're talking to someone here who had concerns over Paul Skeens' fastball shape.
Same.
I'm not concerned about Paul Skeens in the least on July 24th, 2024. That guy is really, really freaking good. Neither of us could predict that he was going to be sitting on his couch messing around with grips and he was going to develop something that he calls a splinker, which was going to be like this pitch that was going to take his whole arsenal to the next level. But here we are, Paul Skeens, really, really good. You know, we're not saying Chase Burns isn't going to be good. You know, you can't really predict pitching development. That's another thing that I think is a theme here, is that there's so much unpredictability when it comes to pitch development. We've seen it. We've seen guys, you know, go to BC and have a 5 ERA and then pitch in the big leagues for the Dodgers a couple of years later. I mean, who is the guy that just debuted for the Dodgers this past week? River Ryan. I think Seattle's done a really nice job of developing pitchers that maybe didn't have the most gaudy college numbers, kind of help them straighten out. It's becoming one of those things where it's like, I mean, you can find really good pitching in a number of different roles anywhere in the draft if you've got the right people in there to optimize, maximize, lean into what guys are good at. So, yeah, I mean, what we're going to talk about here, we're just kind of setting the record straight. We're an educational show. This isn't anything new. This isn't groundbreaking. We don't care to be groundbreaking. But it is important when some of these metrics kind of start to get some legs on Twitter or, you know, wherever else. You know, for the people out there that might be interested in a little bit more information, you know, that's why we're here. So every metric, Jeff, that I can think of in the history of metrics that matter also requires context. So any singular metric that's just floating in space probably isn't going to do you a whole lot of good. This is right up Jeff Pont's alley, GPA. So we're heading down GPA to talk about induced vertical break. Jeff, the first time that this really clicked for me in my head, in tip of the cap to the Milwaukee Brewers, was Josh Hader. All right. Just knocked over, almost knocked over the mic there. Josh Hader had one of the most unique fastball shapes in Major League Baseball, and that's why he was damn near unhittable. I mean, he's still pretty good, but out of the chute, he was throwing something that nobody had ever seen before, and it was because he was a low release height, and he was still getting behind the baseball, and he had a lot of induced vertical break. And from a low release height with a lot of induced vertical break, he created a really uncomfortable angle that no one else was producing in the game, which was very similar to a rise ball to the eye of a hitter, just in terms of how it was coming towards the plate. So that was kind of the first time that induced vertical break made sense to me. And since then, I think it's done a pretty good job of explaining why some fastballs that aren't necessarily 97, 98, 99, you know, some lower 90s fastballs are really difficult to hit. Invisible fastballs, it kind of explains that a little bit, the invisible fastballs. Oh, why is this guy 90, 92? But a lot of guys can't hit it. They can't see it. Probably because of a combination of release height and induced vertical break. So, I'm going to get off the monologue there for a second, Jeff. I do want you to talk a little bit about Chase Burns.
Yeah, well, I think we made some of the point there on Burns. I mean, obviously, it's still a very good fastball. It's going to get 60 grades or better from a majority of people. He does get, you know, above average amount of induced vertical break, especially when you consider how hard he throws, 96, 97, 98 miles an hour. But I do think that at times it doesn't perform as well as we would anticipate that it would, just based on that combination of attributes. And I think some of that comes down to the plane. I think some of it comes down to the angle, like you said. I think that's sort of more of an old school sort of area scout term that's accurate. But until the last few years, we haven't necessarily had the ability to accurately describe it with actual metrics or numbers. And, you know, I think some of it is what we would call vertical approach angle. I know some people are off that because they're like, oh, it's sort of redundant with release height and IVB. But I think when you look at it, it also gives you a component of how efficient the fastball is in terms of how, you know, much of the spin induced movement is active, which is something you'll see as like active spin, or you'll even see it, you know, mentioned as spin efficiency, depending upon what the device is or what the measurement is. The more efficient a four-seam fastball is, the more it stays on that plane. Typically what it does is it it creates a more flat plane, and not flat in the traditional sense. We've said this a million times, but not flat in the traditional sense of being bad, but flat meaning good. Sorry, shout out Run DMC. So it's one of those things where like you kind of see it eat at the top of the fastball. And I think if you hit, you know, on a consistent basis, like you sort of can get to a point, especially kind of pitching machine, right? You get to a point where like the plane, you can sort of predict it, right? Because one of the things about hitting that's really cool is it's physically impossible to hit a baseball, more or less. Like when they've done studies in terms of like what the eye picks up and all that sort of stuff, it's muscle memory. That's where the contact comes down to. And the muscle memory is being able to stay on plane with that ball in terms of how it drops or how it rides. And that's something that just gains guys. I mean, like there's guys with flatter swings. There's guys that are better at hitting the ball at the top of the zone. There's guys that have adjusted to that over the last couple of years, which I think has, you know, brought back some sinkers. But initially that's what we're talking about. Most pitchers are throwing a four seam fastball. The goal is to get behind the ball, throw it hard, get ride, have a difficult plane. But I think, you know, the Josh Hader example was really good because he's left-handed. He's got this really interesting angle. He's got a lower release height. He doesn't need as much induced vertical break to create that flat plane, that difficult angle, as a guy like Chase Burns does, like a guy like Trey Yesevich does. Yesevich doesn't extend as much as Burns does.
So Jeff, let me hop in here and just kind of say a few things. I think like for the people who this is brand new to them, right? The typical, over the years, the typical pitcher threw from a three-quarter release height, right? So if the typical pitcher is throwing from a three-quarter release height, and most of the typical pitchers had similar fastball shape, if you will, then a lot of hitters were seeing a lot of the same thing. Now, there have always been guys who have different, you know, release, you know, high three-quarter, low three-quarter sidearm submarine. That's always existed. There's always been different fastball shapes. None of that's new to the game. But for a long time, it was like that was kind of what you were looking for. And, you know, as an evaluator, it was like, okay, three-quarter release height. And, you know, that was kind of the standard. There has to be a standard. There has to be an average. There has to be a majority of the population doing something similar. So when you're a hitter and most baseballs are coming in on the same plane from a three-quarter release, then – that becomes, you know, the goal of hitting is to match the barrel to the plane of the pitch, right? So a lot of repetitions in hitting came against the same types of approach angle of the ball towards the plate. Now, what Jeff's saying is that you can disrupt that with a lower release height and induced vertical break, because now instead of the ball coming down on an angle, it seems to be coming in a little bit flatter. And that disrupts your natural swing path that you've taken all of these reps over all of these years against, right? And that's why you see a guy like Josh Hader come into the league and have so much success and nobody can hit him. That's also why you see, go on YouTube, you can see the video of big league hitters trying to hit Jenny Finch, and they were never going to hit Jenny Finch because the plane of the softball coming in was just not something that their eyes have an extensive history of repetition against. That's not a swing plane that they're used to taking. And that's why it's damn near impossible for a baseball player to hit a softball pitcher. But Jeff, what I want to ask you is, you know, okay, if we're looking at Chase Burns specifically, and he's got a high release, right? It's pretty much straight over the top. What you know better than I do. You probably have the metrics in front of you. What's his induced vertical break? What's his release height? And what kind of shape does that produce currently without alteration?
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging. You can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. I think we're going to have an opening coming open. When it comes open, I'm going to use Indeed. Why? Because Indeed makes my job easy. When I'm hiring, it puts it all in one place. It organizes it. It does the thinking for me to where I can just connect with quality candidates and do the process that we need to do to hire. That's what Indeed does. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. The heat of summer is here. Whether you're going for a long run or just sitting by the pool, your favorite summer treat could be giving you extraordinary hydration. Liquid IV has refreshing summer flavors like Popsicle Firecracker and Rainbow Sherbet that hit the spot when you need transformative, hydrating relief all summer long. Indulge in hydration with electrolytes, essential vitamins, and clinically tested nutrients from the number one powdered hydration brand in America, Liquid IV. Did you know that blue and pink cotton candy are different flavors? I didn't until I started enjoying both of them through Liquid IV. Personally, I'm partial to the blue cotton candy. I make sure I pour some in my water bottle with some ice before I head out on a bike ride. It not only hydrates, but it's a more enjoyable way to stay hydrated. Blue cotton candy, that's my recommendation. But I've yet to find a Liquid IV flavor I don't like. Cool off your summer with the reimagined flavors of treats like Rainbow Sherbet and Popsicle Firecracker, or make your own Liquid IV popsicles. Indulgent flavors keep your wellness rituals fresh and keep you motivated and hydrated. Find all your favorite flavors on the website. There's acai berry, lemon lime, pina colada. You can even choose from their line of sugar-free flavors like raspberry melon, white peach, and green grape. The white peach, that's pretty good too. Tear, pour, live more. One stick and 16 ounces of water hydrates better than water alone. It's powdered by Live Hydroscience, an optimized ratio of electrolytes, essential vitamins, and clinically tested nutrients that turn ordinary water into extraordinary hydration. Three times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, eight essential vitamins and nutrients. Always non-GMO, vegan, gluten-free, dairy-free, and soy-free. Indulge in hydration this summer with Liquid IV. Get 20% off your first order of Liquid IV when you go to liquidiv.com and use code BA2022 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code BA2022 at liquidiv.com.
We've got all eyes on new at Matalan. Right now, shop new in styles for £20 or less with must-have jackets, stripy shirts, and denim skirts. It's the perfect time to top up your wardrobe. Head to your nearest store today or shop online at matalan.co.uk.
Yeah, so if I pull up the exact numbers here, you know, I think that off the top of my head, it was about 20. These are college numbers. Now, I want to put that out there first. These devices are not consistent. And the reason I say that is they're not always like completely well calibrated. And does the calibration have anything to do with someone trying to do something devious? No, I think that there are just times where mound height is inaccurately calculated on some of these devices. It's just inconsistent. And what mound height does is it can sort of juice what you see in terms of plate height, because that's what's measuring the induced vertical break. The number itself is removing gravity from the equation. And it's just looking how everything would move if the pitch was essentially thrown at a plane of zero. All right. So a curveball moves down. Fastball moves up. There's obviously horizontal movement, which is in there as well, but I think that's the most basic way to sort of describe it. One's backspin, curveball's topspin, kind of the same as a fly ball, you know, or a topspin line drive or a topspin ground ball, sort of the same. So some of these numbers are always a little juiced. I mean, we were getting 22 inches of induced vertical break from Trey Yesevich. Like, that number's not good, you know. So he was averaging 20 this year, sitting 97, 98, from a 77 inch, 77 and a half inch release height. So it's a higher release. Guys who have more vertical over the top arm slots tend to have naturally more ride on their fastball. Think once again of like plate height and how the ball's coming in. I think that a lot, like think Justin Verlander, that was the comp that I you know, have sort of put on some of these guys, Yesovich. Dylan Cease was the guy that I put on Chase Burns, and my friend Lance Brozdowski came up with a similar one when he was in the drafts show. So I think the thing here is like Burns throws 98, 100 miles an hour. All right. So at the very beginning, that gives you a ton of leeway in terms of some of this stuff. Right. And I don't think it's all that different from like Hunter Green. When Hunter Green was coming up, throwing 100 with ride, and we would see guys get on the fastball from time to time. He kind of had to learn to get around just, you know, pitching off the fastball all the time. He's become a better pitcher because of it. So there can always be some sort of concerns with this, but at the same time, no one here is saying that it's a bad fastball. There's a lot of good traits here. Velocity is the most important trait in your fastball, bar none. It's not the only trait that you can have. Burns has other traits as well. So I want to sort of put that out there, you know, as a qualifier when we're talking about this. We're not saying he's bad. We're not saying he's not going to be a great, you know, professional pitcher, because I do think he's going to be very, very good. He got paid the money that he got. He went where he went in the draft for a reason. But I do think that we're both concerned about hard contact. I think we're both concerned about how, and I've said this before, I said it on the fantasy show earlier this week, and it's to steal a quote from you, but really to steal a quote from an NCAA commercial, how he performed against guys who were going to be going professional in something besides baseball, besides sports.
And others.
Because we went through some of those names. There were maybe two or three guys that stood out, right, that were day one picks. I know one was Goodbout from UVA, and then the other one was Zion Rose. And the rest of the guys that homered off of them were kind of like, I don't know, you know.
No disrespect to any of these guys if they're listening, you know, but D. Williams, J. Hinderleiter, C. Hinks, S. Baumgartner, M. Williams, E. Micheletti Jr.
Eddie, he is pro.
Casey Cook got him twice. That's a good hitter. Parks Harbor, C. Wilkerson. Zion Rose, Henry Godbout. There's two good ones there. W. Clark from Duke and R. McDougal from Dayton. And 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 out of 14 home runs he gave up this year were on the fastball. So, look, Jeff, it just goes back to like when I watched him against UNC the first time, and he golden sombreroed Vance Honeycutt with his slider, and then he gave up. I think that was the game. He gave up two to Cook and one to Harbor and one to Wilkerson. He had four bombs that game, I think. Yeah. And then, you know, the regional against Trey Yesovich at ECU. And it was ultimately D. Williams who did him in late. It's not like it was the three hole hitter, you know, it just had a tendency to be the guy who was, you know, 7, 8, 9 in the lineup, whoever it was, you know, taking them deep. So, look, I'm not saying that Chase Burns isn't going to be pitching the big leagues and he's not going to be having success against big league hitters, but there's a lot of guys that I just named there who aren't going to go play professional baseball that are going to be able to say they took a big leaguer deep.
Yeah. No, I think that's accurate and truthful. So,
okay.
And I think the thing with Burns, too, is like the slider is an unbelievable pitch. You know, I had one
– it's a monster.
One professional evaluator refer to it as a left turn at 90 miles an hour. It's like, yeah, like that's a nasty pitch. There aren't many pitches that move like that, that are thrown that hard. And that's one of the things that makes him so unique and the reason that he got paid what he got paid. But I think overall, the bigger lesson here is, as opposed to just saying, hey, he throws this hard, he gets this induced vertical break, it's better than this fastball, particularly when comparing and contrasting with Hagen Smith. Hagen Smith is more along the lines of, you know, I use Matt Strom as a comp in my article when I was comping out some of these pitches. Matt Strom is one of the best relievers, was an all-star, one of the best relievers in baseball. There's just not a lot of left-handers that have a low release height and they can backspin it a little bit. So Hagen Smith in these numbers, you know, in terms of, you know, what the exact induced vertical break is on this fastball, it's like 16 and a half inches, right? And so maybe that's more like 15 and a half, you know, There's also a chance that he's thrown in the SEC consistently. Probably better devices, more calibrated devices than the other ones that we're seeing, even in the ACC or, you know, in the American, right? That's who East Carolina plays in. So you're seeing more consistent devices, frankly. So I think it probably, you know, is more accurate. He's a guy that gets unusual playing. It's not Jacob deGrom unusual, but when we think about deGrom, he's a great example of this because deGrom's release height is so low. He only averages about 16 inches of induced vertical break on his four-seam fastball, but you know, he's averaging, you know, 16 inches of induced vertical break from like a 63-inch release height. Hagen Smith's a little bit higher, 67 inches, but he's also left-handed. He does get behind the ball. You know, he's got a flatter vertical approach angle than Burns does. It's like 4.4. And, you know, I think there's even a chance that that number could even be a little bit lower at some point. You know, as he sort of rounds into form, though he's been developed well at Arkansas, I don't think there's any question about their quality or their pitching development. And it's kind of the same thing with Wake. But, you know, I think when I look at a guy like Hagen Smith and someone can say flat out that this fastball is better than this one, and I'm not so sure that that's necessarily the case because he's left-handed. He's got these unusual release traits. He doesn't throw as hard as Chase Burns, but he's still throwing 95 to 96 and has been clocked as high as 100 miles an hour this year. One of the few guys that, you know, sort of ate Travis Bazzano's lunch over the last 3 years in Division One. There's not, I don't know if there's that's another pitcher that struck him out twice. I don't think. I think he might be the only guy that's done it. And that start against Oregon State was arguably one of the best college starts I've ever watched. When he strike out 16, it was some absurd 17. I have to go back and look at what the numbers were, but some absurd amount. And another guy with a really good slider, really unique. He got paid what he got paid for a reason. And I think that that's the bigger lesson here is that, you know, before you start talking about how a fastball moves and that it's so much better, you have to understand how it plays with the release height, because 16 inches or 16 and a half inches of induced vertical break at, you know, 67 inches is a lot different than, you know, 20 at 78 inches, you know, it's just in terms of how it's coming out of the hand, especially like a right-hander versus a left-hander. And I think we saw that with the hard contact. You know, Hagen Smith made 16 starts this year. Majority of those were in the SEC. You know, he's not on LSU, so he's consistently the last couple of years faced some of the best lineups, you know, day in and day out. And he only gave up 4 total home runs on the season. And I think some of that hard contact comes back to the fastball, which is the most used pitch. And it's also the pitch that guys tend to do the most damage against consistently. I don't care, you know, who you are. There's very few players where their secondaries are the pitches that are actually giving up the most hard contact.
I just kind of want to jump in here and, you know, again, we're an educational program here, 90th percentile. A lot of scouting reports from professional evaluators have multiple grades for a fastball. One is fastball velocity, and one of them is fastball quality or fastball shape. You've probably heard shape. You've probably heard fastball quality. You can hear these things interchangeably, but more or less it's, okay, how do these two things work together? Now, Jeff, it wasn't too long ago that there was a time when there were guys that threw really hard, and anybody in the big leagues can hit velocity. There were guys who threw really hard who didn't have great fastball quality, and I think there were concerns around, as you, the name you mentioned earlier, Hunter Green, there were concerns around the name we opened up with here, Paul Skeens, in regards to the fact that, yes, they had high grades on that fastball velocity, but they didn't have particularly high grades on fastball life or fastball quality, right? So there are a lot of things that have advanced in pitching development over the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years that have allowed pitchers to find ways to be competitive and really nasty, like Paul Skeens developing a splinker. To complement the fact that he throws a really hard, essentially, I mean, it's not quite a dead zone heater, but that was kind of the hot button term for it, was a dead zone heater. Dead zone heaters don't really play. Well, we're getting around that a little bit because, Jeff, like, okay, what are different ways to potentially increase fastball quality, right? I mean, it's, you're going to have to mess with your arm slot potentially. You're going to have to mess with your release height. You can mess with your extension, those types of things. Anytime you mess with your mechanics, you're potentially putting yourself at risk for injury,
right? These are kind of some of the things that start to come into play. So that's why when you look at some of these guys who maybe don't have great fastball quality, they've got to get creative. And again, context is important. Is there another pitch? Is there another pitch that looks similar that's also hard that does something a little bit different that allows that fastball to play up? So, Jeff.
Skeens, as you were saying, is a good example. Skeens' release height is actually 69 inches. Like, and you think about how tall he is, right? A lot of that comes down to extending down the mound. You know, he doesn't have crazy extension, but it's like 6'2", 6'3". The slot is a little bit lower. He obviously commands that fastball, you know, with that velocity. I think the biggest thing, if you want to improve, you want to improve your fastball, it's probably throw harder, right? It's hard to drop your slot naturally and do it in an effective way. We saw this with Mackenzie Gore, was a guy that tried to drop his slot and it didn't work so much. He went back to what his traditional slot was, and he's been a pretty good major league pitcher, you know, not outstanding, but pretty good. I know Paddock was a guy that kind of messed with his slot at one point. It didn't necessarily work. We've seen other guys sort of change their arm action to try to create some of these things. Sometimes that works. I think it's not necessarily all that natural. You know, I think the biggest thing is being able to throw hard and also sort of leaning into what your profile is. There's a lot of guys in college baseball that have grown up throwing four seam fastballs that threw hard, that just dominated everybody because they're facing hitters that, you know, are not as advanced as professional hitters, certainly not as advanced as major league hitters, which is something that we can get into in a little bit in terms of how hard it is to replicate facing a major league lineup in an environment where you're not just facing a major league lineup. Like, you know, it's not like facing a major league pitcher where you can jump on the traject machine in your days off like Kyle Teal. And, you know, I can face Justin Verlander and I can see the most perfect version of Justin Verlander's fastball and, you know, the most perfect version of his slider, et cetera. You know, you can't really do that when, you know, you're a pitcher. You have to actually face live batters. As far as I know, there's no robot at this point that can, maybe they're coming, but there's no robot that I know that can replicate facing, you know, the Los Angeles Dodgers lineup. You kind of got to face the Los Angeles Dodgers lineup, do your scouting reports, know how you're going to attack somebody, and just have a plan of attack that, you know, between you and your catcher and your coaches, that you plan on executing. And
that, you know, robot would be terrifying.
It would be terrifying. Like that, iRobot's probably working on it right now. You know,
try and sneak this 92 mile per hour slider past this robot, and it's just like reflexes, just barrels it right back into your chest.
It's going to be great when we get bullpens, and it's like he gave up 7 runs against the hitting robot. You know,
oh my god.
Before we get too far into the future, though, you know, I think the lesson though is like sometimes there's guys who are throwing four seam fastballs that aren't efficient. They don't have great playing. They get to a level and the traits don't necessarily play as well. And this is when you often see guys switch to a two seamer, you know? Yeah. And I think that's what a lot of people were saying a year ago about Skeens, is that maybe Skeens should switch to a two seamer. Now that splinker, you call it a splitter, you can call it a two seamer. I don't know if they're all that different, frankly. Right. Like there's a lot of crossover traits between changeups and two seamers, certainly as with splitters and changeups and two seamers. You know, they're all sort of in that bucket of similar pitches that sort of lack efficiency. And that's the reason that they sink and move arm side and do the things that they do. That's typically the direction that, you know, you go to, you know, a more traditional sort of four seamer. My cat is now puking in front of me. This is unbelievable. Did get a little hairball action. Can you hear that in the background?
Yeah, I can.
Everybody. Yeah, I'm gonna have to clean this this blanket. That's tremendous. But anyway, so I think that's sort of the direction that a lot of people are going, you know. She's 20 years old, man. You gotta give it to her. She's made it this far, you know. You doing all right, honey? We're gonna have to edit this out. This is
hilarious. No, you gotta keep that in there. You gotta keep that.
JJ's gonna be like, "What are you doing? You got puking cats in the 90th percentile."
This is unedited, unedited, pure, uncut. You're getting the real McCoy here.
You're getting all of it right now. But anyway, right, so
Jeff, yeah, basically what you're saying is that it would not shock you if at some point in the next year or two, Chase Burns went ahead and started either adding something to his repertoire or started doing something maybe a little different with his fastball, or adding something to complement it a la Skeens that kind of allows it to play up.
I don't know. And this is always the tricky part, I think, when we're talking about Wake Forest pitchers. Because we talked about how Arkansas's pitching development is pretty good. Wake Forest pitching development and that lab is world-renowned, right? Like, there's been professional players, positional guys. I remember Anthony Volpe was working on his throwing a couple of years ago. And, you know, he spent time at the Wake Forest lab in the offseason trying to improve his arm and how he threw. We often see a lot of these Wake guys sort of like regress once they come into pro ball, right? Rhett Lauder has not been as outstanding as we had anticipated he would be in the lower levels of the minors. He got hit around a little bit, surprisingly, right? Jared Schuster has never thrown as hard as Jared Schuster threw his last year at Wake. Ryan Cusick is another guy, another first rounder out of Wake, that's had some struggles in pro ball. And, you know, you can blame that on the organization. I'd have to interview these guys to really like have a better comprehension of like what the differences are. But it seems like they're always getting the absolute most out of their pitchers. And it doesn't necessarily always stay that way. Burns is the most talented of these arms. Burns was pretty good as a freshman at Tennessee. His sophomore year was kind of up and down. And then, you know, we then sort of saw what he did this year at Wake Forest, which was obviously outstanding. So I don't think the pitch is going to get changed because I think they would have already done that. I just think it's one of these things that you're going to have to live with. It might be more of a usage adjustment. You know, sort of like Skeens claimed that he had this blinker at LSU and they told him not to throw it.
Yeah.
So it's not that he didn't have it. And I've heard some scouts, conversations I've had over the last week was like, maybe Burns throws that curveball more. It's a really good pitch. It's got a ton of depth at like 82, 83. That's an outlier pitch. Maybe he starts throwing that more and that gives him a different look. But it wouldn't shock me if the fastball usage sort of goes down shortly.
I do think that I agree with you on Wake Forest pitchers being optimized while at Wake Forest. And I mean, I don't know if this is the variable, but I think a lot of pitchers would be more optimized in professional baseball if they pitched every 7 days as opposed to every 5 days. So maybe one of those things that is kind of pulling Wake Forest pitchers back a little bit when they get into pro ball is that they're now on a 5 day.
It could be that,
yeah. It's pitching every 5th day instead of every 7th day, you know, in the most optimized environment that they could ever be in. So, But yeah, I'm with you. Wake Forest pitchers going to pro ball, and I don't want to say it scares me. I'm not going to go that far. It's not that extreme, but I do look at it a little bit differently than, you know, Bryce Miller, or, you know, some of these other guys that go into pro ball and they go the other way.
Well, I also think like it's where you end up, right? Like, I'm more excited about Gerangelo Shinta than I was 2 weeks ago because he's in Seattle.
Right.
We were already sort of driving the bandwagon of the Ryan Sloan, you know, hype bus here. Yeah, we're taking turns. You know, you get about 6, 7, 8 hours into the drive. You're like, Jeff, got to rest my legs. I want to eat a sandwich. Can you hop behind the wheel? I hop behind the wheel, you know. But Sloan's a guy that now that he's with the Mariners, I'm even more in. Like I was saying in terms of like fantasy, like FYPD, this is a guy that like if you're in a 20-team league – dude, after pick 15, after pick 12, I could almost see myself.
I'd take him third.
You take him third overall?
Take him third overall in your FYPD, Ryan Sloan.
I think that's one of those where you're going to get yelled at by your league mates. You're like, you could have gotten this guy at 20, you know? But yeah.
I hope they do yell at me. One of the greatest lines in scouting. One of the greatest lines in scouting that I've ever heard comes from a scout, and they know who they are if they're listening to this. He said, Ryan Sloan is the kind of guy who can throw a marshmallow through the side of a battleship. All right. I might have just moved them up to 2 on my board, honestly. He might have just
every time you say a marshmallow off to the side of a battleship, I think.
I mean, that is just, let me just say that a tip of the cap to the artist that wrote that came up with that line. I mean, like, there, some of these scouting reports really are, you know, it's art, vivid descriptions. So shout out to, I wish Action Bronson was a scout, because could you imagine some of the descriptions of players that he'd potentially have? Like, there's some artistry there to writing up a player and how you describe them. And that is just,
I think you should tweet that out and tag Accidental Bronson, because Action Bronson actually looks at the Accidental Bronson account. I don't know if you followed that account at all, but it's one of my favorite Twitter accounts, and they more or less,
I think I follow it on Instagram.
Yes. But they find quotes that people, or tweets that people make that sound like they would be Action Bronson lyrics. And I feel like, you know, being like, I could throw a marshmallow through the side of a battleship. Like, I could, you know, see it's a bar.
That is a bar. You know, they confuse body with Bruce Willis in Morocco. You know, Bruce Willis. Shout out to Action Bronson. He's a better chef than he is a rapper. I hope he doesn't hear this, but. That's not even a knock on him as a rapper, but he's just one of the best chefs in the world. The world's ever seen.
One of the best chefs the world's ever seen.
Yeah, I do want to cap this out, Jeff. I had nukes last week for the first time. I think that was Mike Robbins' spot.
What is this?
Head coach at NMJC.
Yeah, I know that, but I'm saying
Mike Robbins. His number one sandwich spot is Nukes Eatery. N-E-W-K, Nukes Eatery. It's like a Creole sandwich shop, but like also trying to be healthy at the same time. It's a weird vibe in there. You know, it's spacious. Walk in there, it's spacious. They got the open kitchen concept. Interesting. You know, it's like, do I go over there and order? No, you don't. You're just meant to look in and be able to see these people preparing your salads and your sandwiches. Let me just say, I had like a chicken bacon ranchero type situation on their signature bread, which is like almost like a soft French bread, which is really nice. It's not something you see at a bunch of sandwich shops. And it was good. It was good. I'd throw like a flat 50 on it. It's like sitting right under Jersey Mike's for me. It's definitely ahead of Jimmy John's. It's definitely ahead of Subway, but it's in that middle ground. It's like,
where is this place?
Nukes? I think they're everywhere. They're chains. I think they might be. They might be in the same, under the same family umbrella as like McAllister's Deli. I don't know if you ever heard of that, but yeah, I had a nice fruit cup on the side. Look, I mean, I'm still going back to Capriati's, you know, over Nukes, you know, but Nukes is definitely like, if you're sitting there, you're driving along, you're somewhere in the middle of somewhere that you've never been before and you're hungry and you see Nukes Eatery, like just know that it's not going to let you down. It's going to be fine. It's going to do the job. And you might enjoy the bread, because it's a little different.
The closest one to me is maybe Maryland.
Yeah. So anyway, shout out Mike Robbins. Shout out Nukes Eatery. Shout out Capriati's.
Might be Mississippi. No, there's one in Maryland. There you go. I've been on I was on an eating quest for a couple of weeks. I had was on Texas. First time down in Texas, I crushed some real Texas barbecue for a couple of days in a row. Some of the best brisket I've ever had in my life. The sides were phenomenal. Sausage, you know, like the barbecue sausage is very similar to me to like kielbasa almost. Like it's almost like smoked kielbasa. It's a little different.
Yeah.
But it's okay. You know, I come from the land of like Portuguese sausage, like chorizo, not chorizo, chorizo, right? There's no Z in there. And that linguica, I think those sausages are phenomenal. Italian sausages still ranked that.
Little linguica on the pizza.
Yeah. I had a linguica and egg sandwich today for breakfast in the Cape. So there you go.
I feel like is linguica is like a sausage they put on Greek pizzas.
Sometimes. No. I think they may have linguica available.
You're
out there in like the Portuguese heavy areas of Western Mass. Like Hadley, I think, has a big Portuguese.
No, population. We don't have Greek pizza in Western Mass. I don't even want to talk about this.
Oh, if we could get into the whole Greek pizza debate.
We had one Greek person in all of Western Massachusetts, and I graduated from high school with a Mark Manilakis. He's a good guy.
I don't buy that.
He's the one. I had the Greeks next door too. The Laterras.
They don't go west. They don't go west of Worcester.
You gotta shout out Mary Auntie Laterra. She was the neighbor next door. She was also Greek. Yeah, they were Greeks. They were making baklava like we named.
Yes, but phenomenal barbecue. It was very good. I very much enjoyed it. The ribs were good. I'm a guy who's made a lot of ribs in my life. I've had a lot of good ribs. I think that you can kind of get good barbecue ribs like all over the place. You know, I don't think that's special. I think that the brisket was special. It's just different, right? That said, the highlight was the Tex-Mex food. The Tex-Mex food that I had in Texas was unbelievable. It was so good. The salsas were so good. The chips, you know, fresh tortillas. Just
the tortilla.
You know, we all get like the same crappy tortillas. Even if you go to a good Mexican restaurant in New England, you're kind of going to get those tortillas that they probably bought from the bread shop that makes all the tortillas from every single brand that you see in the supermarket. They make chipotles. They make Qdobas. You know, they just put a different label on it. I've been inside. I had a client, shout out Joseph's Middle Eastern Bread, back when I was in sales. And they started as, you know, a pita bakery. So they made, you know, pita breads, all that sort of stuff. You know, expanded to making different types of bread. Big thing that they made, though, was their big money maker was tortillas that they made for Qdoba, Chipotle, because they source locally, obviously. They're not going to ship them from one place. So, and then they're like all the store brands. And that was one of those places where you kind of figured like, oh, I can buy generic store brand bread because it's exactly the same as all the brand name bread.
I think the further south you get, then you start to run into some tortillerias and you start to run into some authentic tortillas. There was a spot when I was working at USA Baseball in Durham. It was like a Salvadorian spot. I'll go in there sometimes on my lunches to buy a pound of tortillas for like a dollar. You know, it's like a dollar for a pound of tortillas. Like, come on, can't beat it. Homemade.
Yeah. So we've had some good food of late. Sandwiches kind of, you know, kind of been slacking. It's just kind of been Jersey Michael's. Haven't been to any local delis, you know, haven't gone out to eat in Boston, hit up any spots like Lacoste's or anywhere like that recently.
Yeah. So. I went up into the mountains last weekend and I had some beautiful Palisade peaches, best peaches in the world. And I do think that, if you are ever in the western part of the northwestern part of Colorado, so the land between Denver and Salt Lake City, they call it the High Desert. If you're ever out there, there's this town called Montrose, which is about an hour south of Grand Junction. And we're sitting there, and there's a really, really cool local brewery. They did like a 50-50 burger, which was half beef, half bacon. Delicious. All right. What was it called? Horsefly. Look up Horsefly in Montrose. We're sitting out on the deck and we looked up the road, Jeff. And this is where we're going to end this thing. We looked up the road from where we were sitting out on the deck, enjoying our 50-50 burger in a fresh house brewed root beer, which, I mean, that's just like one of the, I don't have words for where that fits in, but it's special. I love a really nice house brewed root beer. But so I'm sitting there, I'm eating this burger and I look up the road. There's a McDonald's within sight and it's only got one arch, Jeff. It's got one arch. And we Google it and it turns out that there are only 7 in the entire world that only have a single arch. We're looking at the Cyclops. We're looking at the Mike Wazowski of McDonald's signs. It was so funky looking because it only had one arch. It wasn't the double arch. I was like, it looked like an egg kind of. We're like, this is so weird. And it turns out.
Is there like a ban on two arches in the area? How did they only end up with one?
It's like one of the original signs. We went on Google and there's an article and they're in the most random places, but one of them's Montrose, Colorado. So we just happened to stumble on one of the 7 McDonald's wonders of the world that doesn't have a double arch. Anyway, I just thought I'd share that with the world.
That's fascinating. Well, on that note, it's been another episode of the 90th Percentile. I hope it was helpful, informative as always. And I guess we're back. We're back rolling. We got some more episodes coming up here at the second half next week.
Yeah.
Be back. All right. Thanks for tuning in. Back next week.